Hello, my name is Carlos Pasquale, Senior Vice President for Global Energy and International Affairs at IHS Markit. And it's a pleasure to welcome you to this series of CERAWeek Conversations by IHS Markit. Today, we're going to focus on issues related to geopolitics in the era of COVID-19, with a special focus on Russia, oil markets, and great power relations. It's my pleasure to welcome for this conversation Angela Stent. Angela is a professor at Georgetown University and the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies. She's a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown. Angela, it's a pleasure to have you here once again.
Well, I'm delighted to be on and having another conversation with you, Carlos.
Well, I'd also be remiss not to mention your most recent book, Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. It's been an instructive volume for all of us, and we thank you for that. It's great context for this conversation. So if I could take just a minute to set a little bit of the context for the conversation. We're doing this in the midst of the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's had a devastating impact across global economies, on health systems, on social systems. It's become a threat to some the politics in some economies throughout the world. The question that we fundamentally have to come back to and face is, how is this going to affect all of our economies? And in the course of that, it's had a devastating impact on energy markets. It's collapsed oil demand by unprecedented level, a total of about 14 million barrels a day that we're going to see in the second quarter of the United States. And at the same time, this has occurred when there has been a rupture between Saudi Arabia and Russia and the group called OPEC Plus. One of the impacts of that has been that Saudi Arabia has pledged to increase its production further. Russia has indicated that it would do so as well. And that, combined with the demand collapse, has led to the prospect of 1.8 billion barrels of oil accumulating in surplus in the first half of this year. The world has never seen something like this. And we've had other conversations that focus on it. One of the impacts of it, of course, has been that it has forced an even greater decline in oil prices. We'll see further declines as we move through the year. Some companies and countries are gonna have to shut in production. And hence, it brings us back to the discussion, Angela, that we face today. With Russia and Saudi Arabia split in their alignment in OPEC Plus, the two of them increasing production at this point in time, what can happen to actually get them back to the negotiating table?
So I think we have to understand the Russian-Saudi relationship has been growing closer and closer since they first signed this agreement in 2016. And until very recently, it was in Russia's interest to adhere to this agreement to keep down production with OPEC. But Mr. Igor Sechin, the head of Rosneft, the largest oil company in Russia, was always very skeptical of this agreement, and the stars then aligned for the Russians to decide at this point, with all of the economic turmoil, with the falling ruble, that they no longer wanted to adhere to the agreement. And so in terms of oil, yes, it's an oil war between Russia and Saudi Arabia. But the Russian-Saudi relationship goes beyond oil, even though that was the main determinant. It's by now a strategic relationship. The Saudis are buying arms from the Russians. They are investing. They've promised to invest $10 billion in different projects in Russia. From the Saudi point of view, it's always good, even though the U.S. is a major ally, to balance with Russia. From the Russian point of view, Russia has returned to the Middle East really as the major power broker there now, the major arbiter in many of these disputes. So there is a security and a political relationship there that goes beyond oil, despite, of course, the great importance of oil. So I would say that we may see this oil war going on for some time, but this does not mean a long-term rupture, and it doesn't mean that the Saudis and the Russians couldn't get together at some later point and then agree again on production quotas.
Angela, really helpful to point out the depth of those relations and the political relations. And one of the questions we come back to is when, because as we're learning every day, we don't have very much time. And this takes on an element of urgency. what does it take to, who can actually make the decision in Russia to open up a political dialogue again? Is it driven by companies, or in the end, does it come back to the one actor that we all always come back to in Russia?
Well, of course, Putin is the most important actor in Russia. He's not the only actor. And I would say in the case of Saudi Arabia, Igor Sechin, again, the head of Rosneft, someone who's very close to Putin, someone whom people describe as the second most powerful man in Russia, it would be a discussion between at least both of them, if not some of the other small number of people who are key advisors to Mr. Putin. I think we have to understand the current situation in Russia. It's very much in flux. Putin has very recently, just a couple of weeks ago, announced that the constitution is going to be changed if the public votes to change it, which would enable him to be in office if he wanted to until 2036. And he justified this by saying there's all this turmoil going on in the world, there's the coronavirus. Interestingly enough, he made his first address to the Russian people since the onset of all of these issues. And he told them that because of the coronavirus, they're now going to delay the popular vote on constitutional changes. It will take place. But for the moment, he wants people to hunker down. People over 65 are supposed to stay at home. They introduced all kinds of stimulus measures because the Russian economy is really suffering from what's happening now. So you might say, with all the economic turmoil, would that not persuade Russia to go back to the bargaining table with Saudi Arabia? But the Russians have been very prudent. They have over $600 billion in foreign currency reserves that they've saved, their rainy day fund, so that they can inject to some extent money into the economy to keep it afloat. On the other hand, people are now saying that the Russian GDP growth rate for this year might be zero, it might be minus two. So I would say we have to look to what's happening economically in Russia and how the coronavirus unfolds there. So far, Russia only has, at least officially, about 700 cases and just a few fatalities, and most of these are in the west of Russia, but that could change. So I think we have to look to all of those factors if we want to think about when Russia might be willing to go back to the bargaining table.
So another part of the when, Angela, may be the political events that are upcoming. The G20 will have its first digital meeting, in itself a historic event. Saudi Arabia, interestingly enough, is the chair of the G20 this year. Russia is part of the G20. Is there a prospect that that can become a forum for dialogue that puts these issues on oil in a broader context that can take on economic issues, financial issues, health issues, and potentially create a mechanism that makes it a little bit easier for both sides to begin to back down from their previous positions and look at what they can do in the context of addressing the global challenges of COVID-19?
Yes, I think that the G20 could well be a forum where some of these issues get discussed. It could take on more important functions now. If we remember, it was first founded, really to deal with the consequences of the 2008 crash. So, and that, the Russians like these multilateral fora, which are not dominated by the United States in the West. As you say, Saudi Arabia has the chairmanship at the moment. So this could be a good face-saving way for Russia, were it to reconsider what it's doing, to do it in this multilateral forum where it plays an important role, where Saudi Arabia plays an important role, and where the US and Europe, yes, they're there, but they're not necessarily the determining countries in this organization.
And indeed, one of the interesting things is that we do need to have many countries participate. When we think about the volumes that we're talking about, a collapse in demand that could be 14 million barrels a day, this isn't something that just one or two countries participate in. But then it raises the question of what can market democracies realistically do in this context? Interestingly, we had last week a conversation between the Secretary General of OPEC, Mohamed Barkindo, and the Texas Railroad Commissioner, potentially addressing this question of the Texas Railroad Commission's historic role in setting production ceilings internally within Texas. Is it realistic that we can see market democracies being willing to rewrite the books and say that in a time of crisis, we really need to rethink what's going on.
It's possible. I mean, it would go against everything that has been done historically. And, you know, the difference between the private sector and market economies, independent private sectors and governments. And of course, in the US, the balance has often tended to be much more towards the private sector and obviously less towards government intervention. I mean, more so than in most European countries. But because we are in an unprecedented situation with this pandemic, and the fact that all of our economies are going to be very and are being very severely hit by that, yes, that balance could change. It would be ironic if it changes, you know, particularly under a Republican administration, which tends to be very critical of what the government of the state do. But it could. So I think we could see a shifting of sands there.
The history books are indeed being rewritten as we work through all of these issues. Angela, if I could take you back to the issue of the Middle East. And as you indicated, Russia has played a weak political hand in a way that has given it a position of strength in the Middle East. Do these recent developments potentially weaken that hand for Russia, or is it insignificant? Is it still going to remain a critical player on Syria, Iran, with the Sunni states, with Israel? Is it able to maintain that balance in such a critical part of the world?
I think so far it probably will be able to. I mean, Russia really came back into the Middle East, having gone from there after the Soviet collapse in 2015, when it intervened decisively to support the Assad regime, which was in danger of being defeated. Now it's in a position where the U.S. has partially withdrawn from Syria, so it has even more leverage in Syria. It has a problem at the moment with Turkey in Syria, but it's still supporting the Assad regime. And we've seen the terrible devastation in around the Idlib area and the creation of more refugees. But I think the Russians are determined to hang in there until the civil war is over, and then they will, of course, be largely responsible for helping to reconstruct Syria. But that role isn't going to change. Their Syrian intervention is not very costly. They don't have that many troops there. They haven't expended that much money there. But it's crucial, obviously, for the Assad regime and for the regional balance there. There are other major partners in the Middle East. I mean, one of them is Saudi Arabia. That's certainly under strain now, but that could change. But then they have better and improving relations with countries like Egypt, with all the major Sunni countries. They have a relationship with Iran that's quite strong. It's not without conflicts and contradictions, but still they're partnering with Iran in Syria and in other places. And then they have, of course, in the last few years, developed a much closer relationship with Israel, where they are. And so that really makes them the only major great power in the region that talks to all countries on all sides. And I don't see that changing even in this tumultuous period and with falling oil prices. I don't think at the moment that's going to change that because they still have a lot to offer to a lot of these different Middle Eastern countries. They're exporting arms to them, nuclear power plants, they're providing security assistance. And importantly, Russia never complains to autocratic regimes in the region about their domestic system, about the way they treat their people. So they can't compete with the United States economically in the Middle East, but they see a United States that's withdrawing from the Middle East. The country that, of course, is moving in economically is China, but that will probably also mean that the Middle Eastern countries, like in many other parts of the world, will be happy to balance China against Russia, particularly with the US that appears to be in retreat.
Let's pick up on that point related to China. China was the country, obviously, where the COVID-19 crisis throughout the world began. It will be most likely the first country which is out of it. It will potentially be seen by some as a villain causing the crisis. It may be seen by others as a savior that becomes the source of demand in the future that can lift other countries out of economic recession. How do you see the relationship between Russia and China now playing itself out when you have the assurance of two leaders who are going to be in their positions perhaps for the rest of their professional careers?
So the Russian-Chinese relationship has become much closer since 2014. I mean, it was already becoming closer. Again, we have to remember that 50 years ago, Soviet and Chinese troops were shooting at each other over the common border. China stepped in after the Russian annexation of Crimea and launch of a war in southeastern Ukraine. It signed, of course, a major gas deal with Russia, the power of Siberia. Russian-Chinese trade has grown. The Chinese are communicating and cooperating on artificial intelligence, on different cyber issues. So there is a lot going on in that relationship that has really made it a strategic partnership, particularly also because they have grievances against the United States and the West for excluding them, for creating an international order in which they didn't have much of a say and whose rules they had to accept. So for all of those reasons, they have formed a closer partnership. And I would say because of US policy most recently, sanctions against Russia, rounds and rounds of sanctions, and then a trade war against with China has drawn them closer together. So, you know, that relationship is pretty close. It's not tension-free. I think it was interesting that at the outbreak of the coronavirus, the Russians took very strong measures. They sealed their long border with China. They wouldn't let Chinese come into Russia. The Chinese complained at the beginning that their citizens were being discriminated against in Russia because of, you know, when it was known that the virus came from there, but now they appear to have gotten over it. And so their tone has changed. And as you say, whatever one thinks about the origins of the virus and the way that it was handled in China initially, now China is appearing to be, you know, helpful to all of these countries, be it Italy, be it a number of European countries providing them with this expertise and also with Russia. So I see that relationship as continuing to be close, particularly again, if the US-Chinese and US-Russian relationships, you know, are both have both been deteriorating, and that the whatever tensions and whatever asymmetries in that relationship, and they're bound to grow in the next few years, whatever is there, it's going to take some time until that has the impact of rupturing the relationship, which is why when some US officials and some of the experts here say the US should peel Russia away from China, I think one thing they forget is it's an existential question for Russia, for Putin, because the Chinese will never criticize what happens domestically in Russia, and Xi Jinping will, you know, support Putin all the time, at least publicly, and the same is true for Russia. And so I don't see this changing anytime soon now that both of them, as you said, Carlos, may be there for the next 20 years.
And indeed, this brings us back to the issue of the United States and U.S. relations with Russia. And as you said, there have been these arguments that the United States should try to peel Russia away from China, but complicated to do in an environment where there's been sanctions, but even more prominently, the political issues of Russia's involvement in U.S. elections. What should we expect in these coming months, Angela, of Russia's involvement in the elections in 2020? Will it?
I think we should expect what we're already seeing, right? So let's talk about social media. We already know the Russians are doing what they did in 2016, using social media to support Black Lives Matter on the one hand, white supremacist groups on the other hand. In other words, they feed into the polarization that already exists in our society, and they understand how to exploit it to get different groups at each other's throats. We read that they were apparently also on social media doing things to support Bernie Sanders. One assumes because were Bernie Sanders to have been the Democratic candidate, it would have been much more likely that Donald Trump would have won. And the assumption is that they would like to see Mr. Trump have another term in office. But I think beyond that, they intervene because they can, and because they like to show that American politics, it's disorganized, it's chaotic, it's polarized. And so they can stand back and say, why do you criticize us, you know, for our system? Look at you, you're a mess. So I think we should anticipate and expect that this is going to continue in 2020. We've already seen, in terms of the coronavirus, things from Russia on the social media spreading, you know, false accusations that the US, you know, the Chinese have done this too, but the Russians have, that the US was responsible for this, or on the other hand, minimizing it, false information. So this is not going to stop. And the question is, is there very much that we can do about it? I think what we have to really focus on is probably our own election machinery. And I gather the Congress still hasn't passed legislation that would allocate funds for doing that.
Indeed, in some cases, our biggest weaknesses are weaknesses that we create on our own, a space that we allow for disruption to occur. Angela, it's been a fascinating discussion. I think you've really highlighted the possibility that there can be a political dialogue. Much of it will depend on the perceptions of political and economic interests on the part of Russia. You've really painted a picture of how Russia, despite economic difficulties and challenges, has made itself a global superpower and reinforced its role internationally because of its political strategy, its international strategy, controversial in many ways, potentially damaging in some cases. In some cases, it could be a critical player in bringing stability, such as in oil markets. And yet, one of the things that's become clear is that Russia is an actor. Angela, you have outlined that in incredibly clear and profound ways. Thank you so much for joining us in the CERAWeek Conversations by IHS Markit.
Thank you, Carlos.